Welcome back to the program here from Coast to Coast, daily, Monday to Friday, starting at noon Eastern, 9 Pacific. Jeff Merrick, welcome back to the program across the Sportsnet Radio Network. You know, it's always a good time to talk about the Philadelphia Flyers. To me, it's been one of the more interesting teams going back to the post-expansion era of 1967. And on this day, as we just talked to Elliot Friedman about a couple of moments ago, it's the 30th anniversary of Eric Lindros, and we're still talking Eric Lindros's trade. We're still discussing that trade, but today when it comes to the Philadelphia Flyers, we are talking about John Tortorella, their new head coach. John, thanks so much for being patient and hanging on. How are you today?
Very good, very good.
Thanks so much for doing this. So let me jump in with, you know, my curiosity of what intrigued you about this Flyers job. Like, I know that, you know, Joel Quenneville, for example, the first question he always asks before taking a new job is, who's our goalie? What's the first question that John Tortorella asks, you know, before he accepts a job?
Yeah, I don't think it's any one particular question for me. I think it's a number of them as far as just where we think the team is, where we think the team can go. You talk a little bit about the personnel. And for me, it's a philosophy of the general manager. And does it work? You know, and I felt there was a very extensive process with Chuck. I heard great things about him. Like I told Chuck, I kind of asked about him. And as they do about the coaches, and I just felt so comfortable with the conversation with him, and really enjoyed the process, and very fortunate to end up getting the job.
You know, now that you're the head coach of the Philadelphia Flyers, it allows me to talk about Fred Shearer, a lot more than I did before, because one of the people that I've always kind of compared you to in some ways is Fred Shearer. And in the 1970s, as you well know, led the Philadelphia Flyers to back-to-back Stanley Cups. And I think it was really misunderstood in his time as far as, like, that team was a real tough team, but there was still a strong accent on skill. Fred Shearer, I still maintain, was one of the more innovative coaches of his era, was one of the only coaches of that era to both study Russian hockey, travel to Russia to learn, study the Tarasov system, etc. And I think there's a lot of overlap there between him and your career, where you may be perceived as, you know, old school, rough and tumble, gruff kind of guy, but talking to anyone who's ever been coached by you or organizations where you've worked, you know, the one thing that keeps coming back to me is he's a really progressive, forward thinker. I don't know if you've ever thought much about Fred Shearer in your life, but what can you tell us about, you know, your philosophy, how you think you're perceived, and how you really are instead?
Yeah, well, Fred Shearer was one of the most unique coaches to ever coach, and it's terrific of you talking of him. And with me, the, you know, perception, I think that's a pretty big part of, you know, like I always say, it's really not my concern what you think of me. And I'm not trying to be smart and rude, but I can't worry about what you think of me. I can't, because there are so many things out there that are just so untrue. But I don't want to fight it. It's an awful way to live, trying to chase perception and trying to get people straightened out. The most important thing for me is my team and my players and the locker room and how I treat them, how I coach them, how I feel about them, and how we feel about one another, the relationship. And, you're asking me, I'm not that guy that the YouTube clips and all that stuff that show. There's intensity. You're going to be pushed. But there's also, you know, I also care about the people. There is some empathy dealing with these guys and going about your business with them, because that's what a relationship is. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but that's kind of how I feel about it.
It does, because the one thing we know about, you know, Fred Shearer as well, I'll go back to that analogy, although people may think it's strained, but I'll go for it anyway. Like, Fred cared about his guys, You know, I remember talking to Dave Schultz about his relationship with Fred and going into his office and showing him the cover of the hockey news that said, you know, Dave Schultz, you know, the hammer is ruining hockey. And he said, you know, listen, my family reads this. This is awful. And Fred said, do you want this to go away? And Dave said, yeah. And he said, well, here's how you avoid criticism. Say nothing, do nothing, be nothing. Now get out of my office. And there's a love there. There's a love there. But you know what Fred's getting at, right, John?
Yeah, well, you know, you go to those office meetings. It's the thing I miss the most as far as being out for a year is the locker room. Are those meetings? Are listening to players about some of what's going on with them personally, having conflict with them as far as wanting more out of them in certain situations in a game or practice or their play in general. Those are all that all builds a relationship. But I don't know where it all came to where. You're just kicking them and kicking them. And you don't care about them. I don't know how that all started with me, but I make no bones about it. It's my job to push athletes to areas that they probably don't think they can get to. It's my job. If I'm not doing that, then I think I'm doing them a disservice. And you know, I truly believe that they will always know where they stand with me. There's always going to be honesty there, and I'm going to treat them as fair as I possibly can. And all that comes into play as you talk about Freddie's stories, and then you have those type of situations in your locker room. That's what I miss most, and that's what you take out of the game when it's all said and done, are those relationships after.
Now, I that leads me to my next question, which is when you were with Columbus and you're coaching against the Philadelphia Flyers, do you ever remember saying to yourself, you know, Travis Konecny has another level? Or Scott Laughton has another level, or Travis Sanheim has another level. Like, what did you think of the Flyers when you coached against them?
Yeah, and it wasn't so much that because I was so worried about thinking about the levels of my players. And I've been very honest about this since I got the job. I've just respected that organization for years, as far as you know, back in the day how they played. And again, I'm not trying to bring this into brawls and the bench empties and all that. That's not what I'm saying. I just think it was a hard team to play against. I go back to 04 when we were playing them in the conference finals, and just the way that series was. It went 7 games. We find a way to win it. But being in the building and how the people were and how they treated us when we were trying to get in the tunnels, going in the room and throwing stuff at us and all the stuff that comes along with that, I said, man, this is just such a great sports town. And it's always interested me, that city and me coaching hockey, that hockey team.
I'm glad you brought up Philadelphia Flyers fans historically because and he won't mind me saying his name because we just spoke this morning because I wanted to clarify the story knowing you were coming on. So I gave Brad May a call this morning and I said, you know, Mayday, years ago you told me a story when John was with you in Buffalo. He was an assistant. John Muckler would have been the head coach. And this was in 1995 playoff thing. It was opening round. It was game one or game two at the Spectrum. I think it might have been the overtime game, so that probably would have been game one. And someone threw something at Muckler. You turned around to bark at the fan. Things got a little crazy. Your tie went over the glass, and the guy grabbed your tie, put his feet on the plexiglass, and started strangling you with your tie.
I was choking, about 5 or 6 players were on top of me when all this was happening. Yeah, I was choking. They had to cut my tie.
Yes. So, yeah, Mayday tells me a story. You know, Jim Pizzatelli, we always think of as, you know, the man that saved Clint Mlarchuk's life, you know, a Vietnam medic. And here he is. Like, I think Mayday was injured that game, but Mayday got down and tried to break things up. And people, like, watching, like, the life leave your face. And here comes Pizzatelli with the scissors and he cuts your tie and saves your life, John.
Oh, God. That's so far ago. And to listen to that story now, it brings back memories. And, that was. You know, I was trying to protect Muck. You know, you assistant coach, you do tape work for him, this and that. If anything's going on with the fans, you protect them there too. So that's what it was all about. And you know, back in the day, then some crazy stuff was going on. I just don't think you'll see that anymore, and you probably shouldn't. But there is some stuff I missed that should be in today's game.
What did you make of, listen, this is, as you mentioned, this is a long time, this is 1995, but, you know, back then you're with the Buffalo Sabres, the next year you go to the Rochester Americans and win the Calder Cup, but what were your thoughts on the Flyers? And because, listen, we all know about Flyers fans, how passionate they are and always have been. What were your thoughts on the Flyers back then?
Yeah, it was, you know, back then, I think there was more, the way I look at it, there was more intimidation going into a building, away buildings. Now, I just think it's all gone. I just don't think, I think you should feel comfortable going into your home building, comfortable going into an away building. I just don't think that's the way the game is anymore or the buildings react. There is some buildings are tougher to play in than others, but back then you go into Philly, you know, that's a tough place to play. And it's coupled with not only the players, and some of the players were on that team back then, but just how the people were, just how the city was with that team. You go in there and you can be apprehensive a little bit sometimes, if that's the correct word. So, yeah, that's what I think about it. And, you know, I'm really anxious to get going. You know, the team has struggled. There's some problems, you know, I think there's some problems within the locker room that we have to fix and get it back to trying to be, at least in today's game, a hard team to play against. That's one of my biggest responsibilities, I think, is to get some personality back with the team and have a tough place to play, a tough team to play against. Are we going to solve all our problems with scoring goals and all this? We're going to try, but I think the first thing is just the standard and how you present yourself as a team is the most important thing that I think we need to solve right away.
Is it possible, and I know you mentioned, like, no one's emptying benches anymore and the games don't take 3.5 hours, but is it possible, and some teams will say, yeah, we intimidate with our power play. Now teams are like, oh, our penalty kill, or some will call it our power kill that we have now. That's how we can intimidate teams. Is it possible? Like, is intimidation still a thing in the NHL for John Tortorella?
No, I don't think you can use that word intimidation anymore. I think what we've lost a little bit in our game when all the rules came in. We were the last team to play in the playoffs. Daryl's Calgary team, my Tampa team in 2004. And it was a war. Billy McCurry was reffing and Billy let you play. It was a war. And since then we had, I think it was either a lockout or strike, I forget what it was. And then the new rules came into play. And I've said this all along, I think some of the new rule changes are fantastic to allow the top players play. But what I think we've lost a little bit, I think we've taken some of the honesty out of the game. We haven't let the players police the stuff going on the ice. I just think we have a lot of rules and supplementary discipline to come into play to take care of that. I'd like to give some of the game back to the players and let them police it. And I think if you let the players police it, can you use that? Can the word intimidation come back into play? I don't know. But I don't think that's ever going to change, though. I think we're going to stay right here. Me, it's a team toughness. It's just who they think they're going to play against tonight. How hard a game is it going to be? I think that's the closest you can come to if you want to use a word intimidation. I just believe in trying to develop a team that's just, you know, you're in for a battle tonight. They're coming. They're coming with their forecheck. You're going to get banged around a little bit in the forecheck. They're going to do some things in the blue paint that they need to do to take care of their goalie, wall play. All that stuff comes into play about being a hard team. I think that's kind of how you got to go about it now in today's game.
You know, I thought about that, and we'll close on this one, John, let you get on with your day. I thought about, you know, what you're talking about here, going back a couple of months when Nick Seeler fought Nick Delorier. And I said to myself, oh man, like Seeler's biting off a lot here. Nick Delorier is a dangerous, dangerous man. And, you know, I'm hearing you talk about, you know, losing some intimidation, identity and all that. I think that did Nick Seeler a lot of good in your organization. Agree or disagree?
Agree. And it's been, you know, even in the process of interviewing, that story's been brought up, and it's high marks. You know, I'll put it to you this way. Sometimes in our game, you know, you may not feel real comfortable in that situation or the toughness of the game or some of the tough parts. But I think sometimes you just have to pretend. There's a lot of pretending that goes on in our league. There's a lot of guys that you may think are is that guy, but he's really not that comfortable in doing it. He's just doing it because he thinks it's going to help his team. I think that's part of today's game. Back in the day, there was pretenders, but there were some really mean people back then, and the game was played differently. It's not going to come. That's not the way the game's going to be played. But I still think there is still some principles of the game back in the 70s and 80s that we can still keep in our game here. And people give me a lot of crap about it when I talk about it, but I believe it. I still think there needs to be some of that identity and who we are and how we're going to go about it and handle it. And, that Nick Seale story was brought up to me a couple times when I've been in Philly.
I'm hearing the echoes of Fred Shiro here, John. I know that's where we started, but I'm just hearing you talk about the Flyers, and I'm hearing the echoes of the fog. We'll leave it at that. Listen, congratulations once again. I know a person like you rolls up his sleeves right away. Have an enjoyable offseason. Look forward to you behind the bench in Philadelphia.
Pleasure to speak with you, and thank you for having me on.
Pleasure has been mine. John Tortorella is the head coach of the Philadelphia Flyers. We thank the Philadelphia Flyers media relations staff for making him available today. And I'll tell you what, man, Fred Shiro, to me, one of the more misunderstood coaches of all time. And if you're of a particular vintage, let's say 50 plus, you may have just thought about Fred Shiro as, you know, the goon coach with the Philadelphia Flyers. He was a guy that had, you know, if you're fighting one of us, everybody else jumps in. If our guy starts, I mean, I think we've all seen, you know, Dave Schultz get caught by a Gary Howitt left, and then all of a sudden Don Selesky jumps in, or Mel Bridgman jumps in, or Hound jumps in, or some, everybody else just jumps in. Watson jumps in. I think we've all seen those videos by now, but underneath all of that, like, it wasn't as if they bullied their way to winning the Stanley Cup. There were skilled players. There were certainly tough skilled players, and we think of Bobby Clark, but there were the Rick McLeishes and the Reggie Leeches and the Bill Barbers of that team as well. And that was a team that at least structurally played closer to what we saw with Soviet hockey, because Fred used to go to Russia to, you know, travel and study Russian hockey and bring some of those concepts back to the NHL. They were certainly a tough team, but a very progressive coach. And talk to anyone who's been coached by John Tortorella, and you'll discover the same things. Like, this is a really interesting hire, because right away, anyone who lived through the Fred Shiro era of the Philadelphia Flyers immediately goes back to that. Just look how he talked about Nick Seeler in that fight about Nick DeLaurier. Like, for the Philadelphia Flyers at that point, it is an empty calorie game. That game is meaningless. But Nick Seeler did himself a lot of good in the organization, to the point where Tortorella mentions that story came up a couple of times during his interview process. Interesting. Ken Weeb from Sportsnet.ca will get on the Stanley Cup final page, and also what's happening with the Jets next. Keep it here.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the program. Just getting back to the mic here. Thanks so much for joining me today. Really fun conversation there with John Tortorella, new head coach of the Philadelphia Flyers. Needless to say, they're going to love him there, especially if you heard him talk about building identity and team toughness. I think you know what we're getting at here with the Philadelphia Flyers. I know there's only so far you can go in today's day and age with the idea of toughness, But if I'm a Philadelphia Flyers fan, I'm listening to the way Tortorella is talking and smiling deeply. We'll see what happens. So we thank John for stopping by the show today. Ken Weeb joining us now from Sportsnet in Tampa. Ken, how are you? Oh, we're waiting. Hang on. We're waiting to get Ken Weeb aboard. Sorry, I got to the mic left and wasn't able to talk to Lance Kennedy because I got a phone call about the Dallas Stars as I went off air. So we're standing by for Ken Weeb. We'll talk more about Valeri Nichushkin specifically. And, you know, we look at all the players on both these sides, Colorado and Tampa, players that are, we talked about this last week, players that are poised to get a huge raise. And I don't know that Valeri Nichushkin gets paid as much as someone like Nazem Kadri does in the open market. And the market for Nazem Kadri will be big. But as far as what he's going to do to his salary, like, I don't think anyone thinks that Nazem Kadri is going to double his salary, but Valeri Nichushkin will. Like, right now, he's in at the value deal of $2.5 million. Double that, and it's still probably a bargain, right? The only thing about it is, he's really comfortable in Colorado. Elliot and I talked about this on the podcast. He's really comfortable in Colorado, and it's a real good fit for Nichushkin in Colorado with that team, with that general manager, who, for lack of a better term, pulled him off of the scrap heap. When his career was in Nowheresville, when he was having seasons of 0 goals and 0 penalties, what exactly are you doing out there, sir? What are you doing with this ice time, sir? Joe Sakic and his pro scouting staff and his analytics department looked at that player and said, something there. It's worth it. It's really worth it, much like a lot of people who follow underlying numbers, for lack of a better term, the analytics of hockey, look at Jesse Puljujärvi, the Edmonton Oilers, and say, let Valeri Nichushkin be the cautionary tale. Someone could score really big by buying low on someone like Jesse Puljujärvi. What was the old Sam Pollock line? Legendary general manager with the Montreal Canadiens. Don't give up on a young player until you're 100% sure. And even if you're 99% sure, you're still not 100. So don't make up your mind. So don't do it. Don't quit on that player. Not until you're 100% sure. You know, there's a school of thought out there right now that says, much like Dallas gave up on Valeri Nichushkin, it wasn't going to be there. Colorado, the beneficiaries. If Edmonton's about to give up on Jesse Puljujärvi, and you may make the point, and it could be the right one, that it's not a good fit there for Puljujärvi, and if he goes somewhere else and flourishes, let's just say, and again, I'm just pulling this team out of a hat, okay? So don't read anything to it. If he goes to the Detroit Red Wings and starts to flourish, or goes to the Carolina Hurricanes and starts to flourish, that it would have necessarily been able to happen with Edmonton. So much of a hockey player's performance is dictated by his situation and his teammates and the opportunities and the coaches, all of it. And it's been a real tough time for Jesse Puljujärvi at Edmonton, but someone out there, if they can nudge Edmonton into finally pulling the trigger on it, could really do themselves a nice little bit of business. Not unlike what Colorado was able to do in picking up Valeri Nichushkin. After Dallas just flat out kind of said, there's nothing here for us. There's nothing we're going to do with this. You know, I wonder how many people in Edmonton are just saying, look, if it's going to happen with Jesse Puljujärvi, it's not going to happen here. Just get the best possible deal you can. Getting sidetracked. But that is the one cautionary tale that is now out there. I think Nichushkin is becoming that cautionary tale for managers all over the NHL. What's the one thing that managers do? Is they look at what is successful with other teams and try to replicate it. And I think Nichushkin is giving some teams cause for pause about players that they're maybe thinking about giving up on. And I raised the Puljujärvi one for a deliberate reason, folks. Wink, wink. I think Nichushkin is showing that you really don't give up on a young player until you're absolutely sure. And you don't give up on a player until your analytics department says, yeah, us two, we're tapping out. Now, I know the analytics battle was fought years and years and years ago, and it's done. It's over. That conversation is finished, but it does bear repeating for some in the back who say that you can't measure heart. You can't measure grit. You can measure all of it. This has been the Stanley Cup Final, and these two teams that are present in it is really another victory lap for building your organization through analytics, because both Colorado and Tampa have done so robustly. So we'll talk about Valeri Nichushkin with Ken Wiebe here in a couple of moments, who's just finishing up a hit for Sportsnet Television. We should probably park some time and talk about Andrei Vasilevskiy, and probably park some time, too, talking about Victor Hedman. Now, for the longest time, just give a little peek into my brain, for the longest time, I've always maintained that my two favorite players in the NHL are probably Gabriel Landeskog and Victor Hedman. Love them. Landeskog, great in game one, real good in game two. Victor Hedman, tough game one. I sort of chalked it up to him getting smacked in the face by Josh Manson's stick and cut him a lot of slack, because after the career and body of work that he's put in front of us, you can cut Victor Hedman some slack and say, okay, one game it wasn't there for him. It happens. But two, we'll see what happens tonight, but this is not the Victor Hedman that we're used to, much like this isn't the Andrei Vasilevskiy that we're used to. But this is a Colorado team that moves the puck so quickly, so efficiently, gets zone and starts firing that thing around. Like, they're not letting Vasilevskiy get set at all. We talked about how the Tampa Bay Lightning, we talked about this last week, how the Tampa Bay Lightning were able to get shots off on Igor Shesterkin before he was able to set up. And we think about that Andre Palat overtime goal and the great pass by Kucherov, but the great release by Palat too, because if he dusts that thing, pauses, cradles, and then releases it, Shesterkin set up and he makes that save all day long. There are two great moments in that play. There's the pass from Kucherov, which is elite and all world, but there's also Palat recognizing that this goaltender is about to get set up. I better get this off my stick as quickly as possible. And the one thing we're seeing now with Colorado vis-a-vis the Tampa Bay netminder, Andrei Vasilevskiy, is they're moving him around and getting him into a place where he loses his right side. You look at the Josh Manson goal. Everything is set up, like everything in Colorado's offense seems to be set up from Vasilevskiy's left going towards the right. That's where, like, if you look at the body of puck movement, everything is initiated on Vasilevskiy's left, or if you're facing him, on your right, and gets eventually finds its way left or to Vasilevskiy's right side. They've isolated the blocker with backdoors, they've isolated the blocker with shots, with tips, with all of it. And two things you ask yourself coming out of Saturday to reinforce this point. One, Josh Manson on a rush, leading a rush, where does he shoot? Josh Manson, where does he shoot? Because sometimes you're a defenseman, you lead in the rush, you just want to get it on net, maybe make a rebound, who knows? Notice where he shoots. It's right blocker side. And then if you look at Burakovsky, not just his goal in the first period, but the breakaway right after it. Much like Manson, you can tell, was instructed to shoot blocker, so was Burakovsky. They all have. That is the area of weakness that the Colorado Avalanche are trying to exploit on Andrei Vasilevskiy, former Conn Smythe Trophy winner. We've got the TV star aboard with us now. He is Ken Wiebe from Sportsnet, and he joins me now. All done your TV responsibilities, big shot. You got your Mac 30 makeup on. You got you're wearing something nice, tighten up that tie a little bit. Can't have a loose collar. You all done your TV responsibilities now?
It's great to be with you. Excellent job on the tap dancing front. No makeup here. I leave that to Sean Reynolds. But yeah, sorry
you
about
don't
the
wear
delay.
Any? Hang on, you don't wear
I do
any.
Not. I
Why
don't.
Not?
No, not yet.
I mean,
not yet.
I've always felt it a little bit weird that the idea of the concept of makeup is to make you look more real or make you look more human. But nonetheless, you never wear makeup.
I just feel like I have a glowing demeanor. So far I've been able to avoid it. But now that I've said it out loud, it's probably going to stop.
Yeah.
So I love your assessment. Just quickly, I was in the scrum with Josh Manson after the game the other night. He was asked specifically about that, if that was a scouting report situation. And kind of trying to dismiss it, but then he kind of said, yeah, he might have had some trouble there previously. Like it was one of those classics where the player knows he's not really supposed to say it, but he couldn't help himself. So that's a great pickup by you, and I think it is definitely something we've seen in this series so far.
You don't want to lie, right? But then, listen, you even just look at if I said, okay, generic hockey fan, I want you to look at the first period of the Colorado-Tampa game. I don't want to have any context, like no game one, no periods two and three. Just look at the first period. Where has Colorado been told to shoot? Or where have they looked to line up pucks? Like all the action of the puck starts from Vasilevsky's left and goes right. Like that's the movement they want of the puck to get it past Vasilevsky. Like it is as obvious as the nose on your face. So I get Manson being apprehensive because, you know, the coaches probably said, don't talk about this, don't say this. But then on the other hand, when you got everybody shooting blocker, including Burakovsky on the breakaway after he just scored blocker, and Manson shooting blocker, and Tappan's going blocker, like, I don't know, Ken, like, it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, you know what I'm saying? Like, chances are it's a duck.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think it has more to do with the fact that Vasilevsky's glove is so exceptional. I don't think he's weak on the blocker. I just think they have a better chance of scoring there. And they've done a great job of getting him moving side to side. And the Burakovsky goal is a great example where the entry was so excellent by Burakovsky, getting it over. And then he just beat the guy. He beat his opponents to the net. So, I mean, some people have been talking about rebound control being an issue. But I'm here to tell you, Jeff, when you're chasing around all the time, I don't blame Vasilevsky for the rebound control either. I think that the Avalanche have done such an exceptional job controlling possession. I mean, everyone's saying, oh, well, the Lightning need more volume. Well, you don't get any volume if you don't have the puck for the majority of the period.
They're...
I mean, the speed...
Sorry, finish. No, finish, Ken.
The warp speed of the Avalanche, it's something that you see it on video, but you can't really feel it until you're in the building. And I think that in a lot of ways, the Lightning have been overwhelmed by the speed at times in this series so far.
There's a couple of things there. One, I've never seen Tampa have this much of a hard time breaking the puck out of their own zone. It's stunning what Colorado was able to do to them on their forecheck. And two, you know, I look at this team and I look what Colorado was able to do to Tampa, and there were like three or four times I'm watching Saturday night and there are five Tampa Bay Lightning players doing what I refer to as elevator practice, just standing still. It's Tampa Bay Lightning elevator practice as collar. And this is 5-on-5. Like this isn't like a power play and you're like, okay, we're just going to, I have this area that I'm taking care of. And so you'd be a little more stationary. Like it's 5-on-5 and they're all stopped. And no one's feet, like they're frozen to the ice. Ken, I've never seen that before. I've never seen five Tampa Bay Lightning players stand still for as long as we saw on Saturday night, specifically in the third period. That's how overwhelming the attack was from Colorado.
Yeah, agreed. And we talk about the Avalanche being a superior rush team. Man, their in-zone time has been exceptional because of what you said. The Lightning have been chasing, and they have had trouble keeping up. It's really been bizarre. Their forecheck has been absolutely relentless in terms of their pursuit of the puck. And the other thing that people don't talk about in terms of the defending side, man, they are exceptional at two things. The pinches along the boards, but they can only do that because the high forward, the F3, is reading that and anticipating the pinch down. I know a lot of people were talking about Cale Makar not having a big impact on game one. Who cares? He didn't get a point or a shot on goal. If he doesn't make that pinch and read on Andre Palat, there's no Nichushkin second goal in the game. I mean, They've been doing that all series long. Manson's been excellent in terms of, you know, being productive, getting involved. But the physical nature, I mean, no one talks about the Avalanche as being a big and strong team, but they're not shying away from the physicality. They're staying away from the after the whistle stuff, but they've been doing an excellent job of initiating some of the contact. But to me, I think that their defensemen are so aggressive, but they're aggressive without being reckless. And I put Bo Byram in this situation as well. I think he's had a breakout series. He was excellent against the Oilers. He's been really good in terms of the elevated minutes since Sam Girard went out of the lineup with the broken sternum. But this is a team that does an excellent job on the defending side. I mean, that's kind of in the hallmark of Tampa Bay's game, but they're the team now doing all the defending, and the Avalanche are doing such a good job when they have to defend, but they've been so aggressive they haven't had to defend very often, and that hasn't really allowed the Lightning's offensive weaponry to get on track. I mean, Steven Stamkos hasn't checked in yet in terms of the offensive game. Yes, Nikita Kucherov ended up on the highlight reel, but for the majority of the series, he's been on the milk carton for the rest of the time. I mean, these guys need to get going. Braden Point is giving everything that he possibly can, but he's not at full speed, not even anywhere close to full speed. Anthony Cirelli, it's tough. I mean, he's got the toughest matchup in hockey right now, Jeff. I mean, Nathan McKinnon, we're talking about the Avalanche. McKinnon, no, they've limited him to two assists. Well, I'm here to tell you, Jeff, every time Nathan McKinnon touches the puck, the building expects something crazy to happen, and it has been happening. It hasn't translated into a bucket load of goals, but McKinnon has done an exceptional job. So, I mean, to me, I think Cirelli's actually played okay in the matchup, but that's how great or a high level that McKinnon is playing at right now, even though they've kind of contained him in terms of the score sheet. He's having an enormous impact each and every shift. So, I mean, man, it's a tough challenge, and, I mean, you touched on it before. I mean, Victor Hedman doesn't look like himself. And to me, the pairing of Eric Chernak and Ryan McDonough, they struggled heavily in game two. To me, both of them look like they're banged up and dealing with something. It's just really looked like the speed has been overwhelming. And, man, it's been impressive to watch. And then what about the depth guys? We're talking about the stars. How about the depth guys on the Avalanche lineup that have checked in and done an exceptional job here in this series so far?
Absolutely. I want to go back to McKinnon here for one quick second. There's a lot in that answer. There's a lot I want to pull out of it, and I want to talk about the goaltenders too. But the point about McKinnon is fascinating. I don't know anyone that gets the zone as quickly and efficiently and as aggressively as Nathan McKinnon does. And remember a little while ago at Hockey Night in Canada watching the game with Kevin Bieksa, and he brought up something really interesting. A lot of teams on the drop will leave two players back, and then they can kind of play catch up the ice. You look at Colorado, they have a single player drop. So the drop is you call it the ladder player. I think that's what historically it was called, where, you know, the team will rush and then they'll throw the puck backwards to a trailing forward who'll grab the puck and attack with zone. And by then the defense has been pushed back and you have a relatively easy zone entry. Kevin said a lot of teams would do a two-player drop, so you have two different options. But with Colorado, it's just Nathan McKinnon. Like, they're just, like, so supremely confident that this guy's going to get the zone. It's a single-player drop. It's that subtle sort of game within the game and things that, you know, coaches and other players notice. It's a really confident move. But it just shows, like, Nathan McKinnon, more so perhaps than anybody in the NHL, certainly anybody in the series, they are so confident that this guy can get the zone. He's the only player when he's on the ice. He's the only player available for the drop. It's fascinating.
It really is. And here's the thing. There's two ways you can try to play it, kind of try to clog up the neutral zone. But if you do that, you have no gap control. And if he gets by you, forget about it. If you're flat-footed, McKinnon has already – yeah, exactly – the Roadrunner has gone beep, beep, and you're looking at the back of his jersey.
That's good.
And he's just been exceptional. I mean, these guys are this is a good defense corps that Tampa Bay Lightning have. But it literally, every time McKinnon touches the puck, you think he's going to blow by the guy. You remind me what your term is for him, but I love when he gets those legs churning through the neutral zone. Yeah, there you go. Exactly. The flat-out rhinoceros. He is just absolutely, he attacks the ice. I love the way that McKinnon has played. And it feels like there's going to be, I mentioned in my column the other day at sportsnet.ca, it feels like there's going to be a Mario Lemieux dangling Sean Chambers kind of moment in this series. But it's going to be happening at warp speed. It's not going to be happening the way Mario the Magnifique used to be able to make it look slow. Like, McKinnon's doing this in, like, hyper speed. And it feels like he's going to leave. It feels like he leaves a trail of Lightning players in his wake, like literally almost every shift that he's on. And having said that, I think Tampa's doing a decent job of defending against him. But McKinnon's had a huge impact on the series. But right now, we were talking about it this morning, and this is not a knock on McKinnon, but right now I would have him third on the Conn Smythe ballot. I think Makar is a clear-cut number one, and I think Valeri Nichushkin is number two the way that he's played in these playoffs. He's been exceptional both in terms of the two-way play, his board battles. I mean, I read about it yesterday. I mean, this is a guy who's going to be a top-flight free agent this year. I know that Anthony Stewart's been sort of beating that drum all season long, and he's right. But as Elliot was saying with you on the 32 Thoughts podcast, Jeff, I think that Nichushkin understands how great of a situation he has here. There's nine UFAs. Yes, Joe Sakic has some work to do. But, man, if you can tie yourself to playing either beside McKinnon or someone on that second line for the next stretch of time, I'm pretty sure that's a deal that I'd be comfortable signing up for as long as the money is right. And the money could be north of $5 million for a guy that's on a deal for 2.5 right now.
Yeah, don't disagree at all. And, you know, to your previous point about Nathan McKinnon and his Mario Lemieux moment, if you're the Tampa Bay, if you're one of the blue liners for the Tampa Bay Lightning, you have your job and then you have another job, an internal job, and this probably pushes you as well. Don't be Sean Chambers. Don't be that guy who's going to be, you know, on the Sean Chambers part of the video, the Nathan McKinnon video, when it finally does happen. That's your job. Make sure you're not Sean Chambers every single night.
You know, bang on. And it's kind of easier said than done, though, Jeff, don't you think? I mean, man, like the rate of speed that he is playing at is just dynamite. And how about, we haven't talked about the power play. Man, oh, man, how about the puck movement there? I mean, all teams are looking to improve their power play. Yes, they have all this weaponry at their disposal, but the interchanges they have with Makar and McKinnon, I mean, it is just absolutely a treat to watch. And then, oh, what happens? Oh, it's the second unit that comes through with the power play goal. I mean, it's just been awesome to watch. This team is just playing at an incredibly high level, and, man, it's a real treat to watch them sort of in full effect here. But we talk about tension all the time in a series. We need tension, and tension would mean the Lightning coming up with their best effort and coming through with a win one of these two nights. But sorry, I'm going to the buffet table here again. But you've seen it on TV, Jeff. The atmosphere at Ball Arena has been absolutely bonkers. Could you imagine if there is a Game 5? And again, we're not getting ahead of ourselves, and the Lightning could just as easily get right back into the series tonight, even after the one-sided loss. But boy, oh boy, whether it's the sing-alongs or the atmosphere in general, it's been such a treat to watch. And I know the players don't care if they went at home or on the road, but as a fan of sports, I just think that it would be exceptional to have the cup in the building. Whether they win it or not is up to them. But boy, oh boy, it's already been an unreal atmosphere, but it would be exceptional to see what it'd be like to elevate to that next level if the trophy is in the building.
Okay, let me ask you about trophy in the building, because Elliot and I got into this on the podcast not too long ago. I'm curious about your thought. There was, as Elliot pointed out, a conversation about the Stanley Cup making an appearance in Game 1 during the anthems, sitting at center ice as a way to indicate, okay, this is what everybody is playing for. And then it goes away and doesn't come out until the cup is awarded. We all know the great shots of the Hall of Fame guys with the white gloves and the box and shining it up and everything. That is, it's fun, it's tradition, it's historical, and I get all of it. My thought about the Stanley Cup is, and I love these shots with soccer, for example, I think for the Stanley Cup final, this cup should always be on display. It should always be, I think it should be in an area where the players can either walk by it getting to the ice or skate past it once they're on the ice. Maybe you enclose it in glass somewhere so the players can always see it, so fans can always see it. So for TV cutaways, it becomes a really obvious shot. I mean, some of the two shots with the cup could be glorious. I don't know whether you have it close to ice level, you have it hanging up higher. But I think that part of the presentation of the Stanley Cup final should be the cup available for everybody to see in the arena and at various times on their television as well. And for both teams, they need to always be aware that that is what they are playing for. Are you Team Friedman? Who doesn't like that idea? Or are you Team Merrick, Ken Wiebe?
Oh, boy, you're putting me in a real pickle here, my friend. I love both.
I'm just gonna open an envelope and decide how much I put in here. Are you Team Merrick or are you Team Friedman, Ken Weeb?
Well, Team Switzerland. I'm gonna go with Team Switzerland here. I'm gonna say I love the premise, but here's the thing. I was involved in that interview on Media Day with Gabe Landeskog, where the cup was kind of over his shoulder, and it's amazing to see. I wouldn't say it made him uncomfortable, but when you get so close to it, if you're kind of distracted by the old silver chalice that's over here on your right in your periphery, you lose kind of focus on the task at hand. And I think that's probably, I'm guessing that's what Elliot's argument was. I just think that I'm okay with the premise. I'm just not sure that the players are comfortable with it. But maybe it's not for the players, right? Maybe it's for the the game itself.
It's for the moment. It's for the final.
I think that like, agree or disagree with me on this one. This is no disrespect to other sports, but the Stanley Cup is the best looking trophy anywhere, in any sport.
Confirmed.
In any sport. Yet we hide it in a box the whole series.
No, totally fair.
It stays away.
I'm on Team Merrick for that part. I'm on Team Merrick on that front, but we might have to tweak the incorporation. I like the premise. We have a working theory here.
Okay, so your Team Merrick's all text Friedge and say, "Hey, we've just called you an idiot on radio. That's awesome. That's all I was looking for."
What I was going to do was say I was going to borrow one of Elliot's lines. It's not your worst idea that you've had.
Jeff, yeah, it's always prefaced like this. Jeff, you've had some bad ideas, but this is not one of them. What's the old saying? It's an 18-inch difference between a pat in the back and a kick in the ass. Yeah, that's Elliot kind of doing it at the exact same time with me. Okay, so a couple of minutes left with you really here. Ken, I want to transition away from the Stanley Cup conversation and into the Winnipeg Jets. And as I understand it, this is going to be a big week for Barry Trotz and the Winnipeg Jets. Now, a couple of things I know. Barry Trotz is from Manitoba. Manitobans want him to come home. The Winnipeg Jets organization would love Barry Trotz to coach their team, as would every single business in Manitoba who are trying to ensure that Barry Trotz never has to reach into his wallet for the whole time he exists in Manitoba, whether it's beer or newspapers or food or what. I'm missing a whole bunch here. It seems as if, Ken, correct me if I'm wrong, the entire province is rallying around the idea of bringing Barry Trotz home.
It's true, and it's been fun to watch, even if, though for me, it's mostly been from afar since I've been on these last two rounds here, but it is exceptional. It's another kind of, it's a little bit of crowdsourcing here, and it's kind of a regional kind of prairies type of thing. Barry is beloved in this province, whether he's been coaching the Nashville Predators, the Washington Capitals or the New York Islanders. This guy has great roots from his Dauphin Kings days, from his time at the University of Manitoba Bison. He is such an incredible human being, first and foremost, let alone the job he's done as a coach. I think it would be exceptional if they can get the deal closed. And everything you said is bang on. I think this is a guy who's making one of the most important decisions of his life. And he is exercising caution, and for good reason. And the reason that is that this might be Barry's last job behind the bench, Jeff, right? So he's looking to make sure it's the right fit for him. We know the family situation. He would have support wherever he's going to be. I think he lost his mom this year, which was a very tough thing to go through. His dad is still up in Dauphin there. I think here's the other thing, and you and I have talked about this, and you've talked about it with Elliot. Barry is going to be an exceptional manager when he wants to be. I still feel like he has that passion for the teaching element and the chase of the cup. Yes, you have it to a degree when you're upstairs, but to me, Barry's a guy who thrives on the bench in helping players get better individually and helping the team succeed. I think he wants one more job, and I think the Winnipeg situation gives him the best chance to transition into that management role whenever that time is. If it's 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, whatever it ends up being, I think that Barry would have a great fit there. I said it to you from the beginning. Money will not be a concern. We know he turned down a lucrative deal with the Flyers. The Jets are going to be willing to pay. This is an investment in the brand. This is a team that didn't have a single sellout last year, Jeff. They had a tough year, even though they had great expectations. Barry Trotz could help solve a lot of the issues in terms of structure and accountability and all those things, bringing a new voice behind the bench. I still think there's a better than average chance it happens. And if it doesn't happen, I think it's because Barry has decided he'd like to take the year off to kind of reset, similar to the conversations we've had with Paul Maurice and you've had with Peter DeBoer about how tough the pandemic was for coaches, not having the interaction, not having that buzz in the building. But to me, I still think that, I'm not saying it's a done deal by any stretch, because Barry still has, I don't think Barry's decided yet, but I still think there's a better than average chance that Barry Trotz is the head coach of the Winnipeg Jets in the fall. And if that happens, there will be, honestly, this feel, I was thinking in my right now as you've been talking, to me, this has a save the Jets kind of feel, like the year that they were trying to prevent them from going to Phoenix, honestly. Hmm. It's obviously not the same type of circumstance, but the way that the community has rallied, that's kind of how it feels like to me. That, and not to say that it's just Barry is going to say, you know, be the savior and solve all the world's problems, but I think that people, they're just so proud of one, having one of their own behind the bench would be something that they would really take a lot of pride in. And you'd see the results at the box office and on the ice. And it'll be interesting to see how it plays out this week. That's for sure.
No, there's, make no mistake about it, Barry Trotz is an outstanding coach. The resume and the body of work speak for itself. I just wonder, too, how much of this, from Winnipeg's point of view, is we need a good news story right now. This season did not end the way we wanted. This season did not go the way we wanted, and all kinds of question marks about who's still going to be on this team come next season. Will Scheifele still be here? Is Pierre-Luc Dubois interested in a long-term extension? If not, do we need to make a decision? Like, there are like horrible and tough decisions here for Kevin Cheveldayoff and the Winnipeg Jets. Is there part of this decision, we need a good news story in here, and we need one now?
Yeah, I know where you're coming from, and again, I'm okay with the premise, but this is not a PR stunt by the Winnipeg Jets. They're trying to lock down one of the best coaches in the history of the National Hockey League, but the importance of having that done, given the timing, I do agree, it would be something. They're looking for a win, an off-season win, when there is some of this sort of up in the air kind of mentality and all the questions about who's going to be there, who wants to commit, who wants out, who wants to maybe have a new coach, who needs to do more. I agree with you. There is an element to that, but I think the larger element at hand is that after a year where they failed to live up to expectations, yours, mine, mm-hmm. and a lot of other people's, they are looking for a solution. And one of the solutions would be getting a guy who focuses on the things that Barry does extremely well. And the fact that he's local is a bonus. I mean, they wouldn't be hiring Barry to sell tickets, but they would probably be selling more tickets if they hire Barry. We got a little bit of chicken and egg going. But to me, it's not about winning the PR battle. It's about getting things turned around for a franchise who, went to the conference final in 2018 and has won one playoff series since. I mean, it's more about trying to maximize the core, or else realize you're going to have to change the core to a degree if you want to get to the next step. Because right now, the gold standard resides in the Central Division. And right now, a lot of teams are looking around watching this series and thinking that they're light years away. But the Avalanche are also the great story that they were light years away not long ago. So, again, obviously, Joe Sakic's done an incredible job on the management side. And yes, they had to kind of have Cale Makar fall into their lap after that historic season of losing. But at the end, they still got the job done and made the right moves, and they got their stars to commit. And now they've found the structural element that they were kind of missing when they had 3 years of disappointment. So I think the Jets are among the teams that are looking at the Avalanche and saying, hey, maybe we're not as far away as we think, but we're going to have to get things tidied up here. And tidying things up means getting the coach that can help make an impact.
Let me ask you this as we a couple things I want to ask you before we go today. I like you, think that Barry Trotz eventually ends up in management somewhere. And right now the opportunity might be Nashville if he wants it right now. I got to know Paul Maurice initially when I did color for the Toronto Marlies when they moved from St. John's to Toronto. I did it for a couple of years with John Bartlett and got to know Paul. I've always, watched his career and stayed in touch. And he's a really thoughtful guy who understands the league at a lot of levels. You got to know him in Winnipeg, coaching the Winnipeg Jets. I've always thought that eventually Paul Maurice ends up in management somewhere. He's a really good coach, but I can see him as a manager somewhere down the road. Do you have the same feeling about Paul Maurice?
I don't. And not that he couldn't be great at it, because I do think he could be great at it. But to me, Paul kind of lives and breathes with the day-to-day, whereas as a manager, you always have to take the long view, except once the deadline is over and you're into the playoffs. then you can feel that buzz. To me, Paul is a guy who thrives behind the bench. He loves the in-game adjustments that are required. He loves the, you know, trying to pull the most out of the 23rd player on the roster. I think he's getting back to the play. I don't think he's going to be necessarily behind the bench in the fall, but I think we're going to see Paul Maurice have another head coaching job before we see him get into management. That's not to say he might not do it down the road, but I think Paul is the guy who loves getting up at 5 in the morning and going to the rink and looking for solutions. And not that you aren't looking for solutions when you're in a manager job, but I think that he enjoys the coaching and the cat and mouse game more than he would roster construction. And again, that's not to say he wouldn't be good at it, but I just think that he's a guy who thrives under the coaching environment. It's everything that he's known in his life. He may want that other challenge down the road, but for right now, I think that we're going to see Paul Maurice. He could be one of those in-season hires, but Paul's the kind of guy that's at the point in his career where he can choose the job. He's not just going to take a job for the sake of saying, oh, hey, I'm an NHL coach again. It's my identity. That's not how I think. I think that Paul is looking for a specific job in mind. I don't know which job that is, but I expect Paul's going to be coaching again before he's in management, Jeff, and we'll see what happens from there. But that's just how I feel right now, and it'll be interesting to see how that evolves as well.
Okay, I liked you when you agreed with me on my Stanley Cup take, and now I don't like you now that you've disagreed with me on Paul Maurice. But I will ask you one more before I let you go this afternoon. And Ken, listen, you're really generous with your time as always. What do you think happens tonight? Like, part of me thinks that the Colorado machine just keeps on rolling along, and maybe even bigger part of me says, I can't believe we'd watch Tampa go out that easily, and I could see them winning Game 3 here. What do you think happens tonight?
Well, I'm back on Team Jeff on that one. As easily, I just think as media members, you kind of have a little bit, you got to be wary of the recency bias. And, you know, you guys have talked about it on the podcast, Elliot's favorite final, 2011. Well, after two games, how did people feel about the Boston Bruins in 2011? They thought it was going to be a cakewalk and the series would be over quickly. And that's not how it turned out, as we know. And myself, having been in the building for Games 2 and 7 in Vancouver as well, man, oh, man. To me, it just feels like, you know this, this is a proud group. John Cooper is one of the most exceptional in-game manager, you know, managing coaches. I think you're going to see Andrei Vasilevskiy play an exceptional game. And sorry, I got to turn this one back on you quickly before I go. Were you on team pull Vasilevskiy or leave him in for the third? Because I defer to John Cooper, but I didn't like the body language after the slumping after the Makar goal. That looked to me like a guy who felt he maybe shouldn't have been in there. But I agree with your premise that maybe they have an arrangement. But to me, yes. I thought the best thing for the Lightning would have been Brian Elliott, enjoy the third. Andre, take a seat. We need you in Game 3. Take a breather, reset, and go steal us a game in Game 3 and make this a series.
I'm on Coach Weeb, not Coach Cooper's team on that one. I thought coming out of the third we were going to see Brian Elliott. I really did. But I do wonder, like I mentioned on the podcast, I wonder if there's already been that conversation. And Vasilevskiy, as the century said, you know, as long as I'm healthy and I'm not injured, I stay in. Do we understand each other? That wouldn't surprise
exactly.
me at all.
Me neither. But I think I was surprised that he left him in. And I think I'm not saying it was a mistake. I expect Vasilevskiy to be great today. Is that going to be enough? I'm not sure. But for the sake of the series and for someone who's not quite ready to go home yet, bring on more than I want 5, 6 and seven, if there is one. I mean, I want the series to live up to the hype. We've had a couple unbelievable series, but it's kind of been, some of them have been duds. Like haven't gone as much as I just think there will be a counterpunch delivered here at some point, whether it's today or tomorrow. I would think it's more likely going to be today. Tampa knowing the level of urgency required to get back into the series. Because let's be honest, it's tough enough to try to win 4-5. If you got to win 4-4 with no margin for error, you got yourself a big problem.
They've been there before, Ken Weeb. They have been there before. Listen, always great catching up. You be well. Enjoy Game 3, and we'll check back soon, pal.
Thanks for having me, and have a great day, my friend.
There is. Ken Weeb from sportsnet.ca covering off the Stanley Cup final. Also, well, he is in Tampa right now and also does a great job as our beat reporter on sportsnet.ca for the Winnipeg Jets, a team right in the, like, right in the center of the Barry Trotz conversation right now. The entire, trust me, folks, the entire province lobbying for Barry Trotz to come home. They want the old Regina Pats defenseman to come back to Manitoba. I know Regina's in Saskatchewan. It's okay. They want the old Regina Pats defenseman to come back to Manitoba and Winnipeg. He's from Dauphin, Manitoba. And every business in that province is making sure or trying to make sure that if he signs with the Winnipeg Jets, the second thing that happens after his signature goes on a piece of paper, cobwebs start to grow around his wallet and he never has to buy a thing again in the province of Manitoba. On that, we'll pause. More of the Merrick Show here in a couple of moments. We have a signing in Vancouver to let you know about, and we'll get you all set for game two tonight. Pregame at 7:30 with your host, Ron McLean. The puck drops just after 8 o'clock. The venue shifts from Ball Arena to Emily Arena, Tampa and Colorado. Game three tonight. Watch it on Sportsnet and CBC. Merrick Show, more of it in a moment. Sportsnet Radio Network.
Everything Raptors, before and after the games. The Raptor Show with Will Liu. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Andrei Kuzmenko. Remember that name. Just signed with the Vancouver Canucks, so welcome back to the program. Vancouver, well, Dan Milstein is his agent, tweeting this moments ago. Let me grab the Milstein tweet. Where'd you go, Dan Milstein? Where are you? One of my favorite hockey agent follows. Dan Milstein from Gold Star. Confirming Andrei Kuzmenko's intent to sign with Vancouver Canucks, contract details to be worked out soon. Kuzmenko is, you know, considered the number one European free agent this offseason. The Edmonton Oilers, it sounded like it was coming down to two teams. And at various times, you know, it sounded and felt like the Edmonton Oilers were going to get Kuzmenko. Bruce Boudreau helped in the efforts for the Vancouver Canucks, which, as we all believe, helped to put it over the top for Vancouver. So even though he may not have been the coach of choice for the Vancouver Canucks management, he's proving to be an excellent recruiter. Boudreau helping getting Andrei Kuzmenko, who has played St. Petersburg in the KHL the last four seasons. This past season with 53 points in 45 games. That includes 20 goals. The season previous, 37 points in 57 games. That includes 18 goals. He is a right shot, traditional Russian player, off wing, left winger. For more shooting, folks, 5'11", 200 pounds, Andrei Kuzmenko. And he's a 96, so he's 26 years old. So we're not talking about someone in the 30s or anything like that. And then the question becomes, where does Kuzmenko fit in the Vancouver Canucks lineup? And I think even before you ask yourself that or begin to answer that question, you probably say to yourself, if you're a Vancouver Canucks fan, well, who's still going to be here? You know, which wingers will be in his way? Who is he going to play over? You know, is JT Miller still going to be with the team? Is Tanner Pearson still going to be with the team? Is Brock Besser still going to be with the team? And those are just the forwards. We can have the, you know, defenseman conversation at a later date. Is Jason Dickinson still going to be with the team? The one thing we do know about the Vancouver Canucks is job number one is they need to create cap space, and that'll be mission number one, and we'll see that leading into the draft. I think the one thing you can safely assume is that as part of any type of arrangement or agreement with a team, considering there were a number of teams bidding for his services, and the other one that I mentioned, obviously the Edmonton Oilers, this will be a player who walks into the top six. This is a player that walks in and will play with, you know, either Bo Horvat or Elias Pettersson right away. And he'll also be given power play time. So that is the situation there. That's a huge get for the Vancouver Canucks. You know, we always talk about, you know, how you get free players and how you, you know, construct your roster. And certainly you have to draft. That's an obvious one. There are some teams that work a lot more with trades. And, you know, you look at players like, well, I mentioned Pearson and Miller. You probably throw Connor Garland into that equation as well. All three of those were acquired by trade. You look at, I mentioned Elias Pettersson, Bo Horvat, and Brock Besser. Those were all drafted. So it's a combination of all of it. And this one is just flat out a free agent signing. And it's the quote-unquote outside of the money. It's a free player. You didn't have to give up anything to get this player. So congratulations to the Vancouver Canucks. That is some very tidy work by them, alongside Patrick Galvin and Jim Rutherford, their entire organization. And I can't stress enough as well, how about Bruce Boudreau doing some of the recruiting on this one? The Bruce Boudreau charm offensive working for the Vancouver Canucks as it helps them land, you know, a free agent we've been talking about for quite a while now. When it became obvious he wasn't going back to the KHL and was going over to the National Hockey League, look for Andre Kuzmenko to play top six with the Vancouver Canucks next season. So here we go. It's game three tonight, Emily Arena in Tampa. I don't think we're expecting a 7-0 score, folks, although Colorado is capable. Heck, Tampa is capable of putting up a 7 spot. We haven't really seen someone like Darcy Kemper tested. We just haven't. Like, Darcy Kemper has been okay. He's been good. And the point that I've been making about that is that's okay that he's okay. He hasn't been put in a position where he has to be great. You know, you can make the argument that the New York Rangers put Igor Shesterkin, not just in the playoffs, but all the regular season as well, in situations where he had to be great. And thankfully for the New York Rangers, he's great. And that's why he's going to win the Vezina Trophy. And that's why he's considered, you know, by many to be the best goaltender in the world right now. I am, in fact, one of those people who says that. But Darcy Kemper hasn't been put in a position where he has to be great. And we look at Stanley Cups where I don't want to see the teams have to overcome their net minding. I can think of one Stanley Cup final where that was very true, and that was 2010. Antti Niemi and Michael Layton, where Chicago had to overcome average net minding. Philadelphia couldn't overcome theirs. And that was a series where you said to yourself, listen, whichever goaltender has the nerve to make a save first, that team is winning the Stanley Cup. And the Chicago Blackhawks ended up being the team that got that save, and they won the Stanley Cup. But this is a team right now that can overcome having average goaltending, because their blue line is so incredibly dynamic and their forwards are incredibly fast and incredibly efficient and clinical in their zone entries, the way they move the puck around, their shot selection, all of it, their gap control, their puck transition. Everything that Colorado did in games one and two is something they intended to do. There were very few accidental plays made by the Colorado Avalanche. And that might be the most impressive thing about the Avs right now. And even more impressive, they're doing it against Tampa. The fact that your hockey brain says, this is what I want to do, and then you just go and do it. Normally, every hockey player says, this is what I want to do, but then hockey gets in the way and it's broken play, you cobble something together, and it happens. The scary thing about Colorado is you get the sense that everything that they are doing and how they are doing it is exactly how they want it to happen. They controlled game one. They controlled game two. The venue shifts. It's Tampa tonight. What do the Bolts have in store? Because the team that we saw in games one and two, not the Tampa Bay Lightning we've seen over the course of these playoffs, or the team that we've seen over the course of the last couple of years. I want to thank Ken Weeb from Sportsnet for stopping by. I want to thank John Tortorella of the Philadelphia Flyers, their new head coach, for stopping by. And as always, Elliot Friedman. Tampa, Colorado, Game 3 tonight. Enjoy.